The Global Consciousness Project, also called the EGG Project, is an international multidisciplinary collaboration of scientists, engineers, artists, and others. In a moment, we'll talk with Dr. Roger Nelson. He founded the organization in 1997. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Roger Nelson, professionally trained as an experimental psychologist, but his background includes just a broad range of experience in research, design, and analysis, as well as academic work in physics and statistics as well. As I mentioned, director of the Global Consciousness Project, which he founded in 1997. Here he is on Coast to Coast, Dr. Roger Nelson. Roger, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George.
My pleasure. Tell me how you started this. What were you able to do that even conceived this? This is a remarkable project.
Well, I think it grew kind of naturally, one might say, but I think there's also a series of what some people would call synchronicities or meaningful coincidences that led to it. I was working in this area for a number of years before, in an area having to do with consciousness and interactions with physical systems at the PEAR Lab in Princeton University. That's Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research, from 1980. And then somewhere along the way started doing expanded versions of the laboratory experiments, taking miniaturized random event generators or random number generators out into the field to ask a question about consciousness in groups. And wasn't very hard to move to, from that to large groups. So at some point we decided to set up a system that would record such data continuously for indefinite periods of time, which turns out now to be more than 10 years, and to do so in a network that's spread all around the world. And that's what we call the Global Consciousness Project. And in the meantime, we are, I think you might say, pretty well convinced it was a good idea to
sure
move out of the lab and look at the real world.
Tell us about the eggs, first of all. What are they?
The eggs is a name that we give to the individual devices, which are random number generators. They're physical sources of randomicity in particular. Well, we have a couple of different types, but they are electronic. They use electron tunneling in diodes or field effect transistors. And what that amounts to is a quantum process where an electron that's being pushed against a barrier in a circuit that's designed to do that, where those electrons actually penetrate the barrier and wind up on the other side, even though in classical terms they shouldn't be able to get there. And that creates a tiny voltage on the other side of the barrier. We sample that at regular intervals and extract a voltage that's high or low, depending completely on chance, completely unpredictable. Those samples we turn into bits, ones and zeros. And then the result is a sequence of completely random, unpredictable ones and zeros, which is essentially equivalent to flipping a coin at very high speed and getting a sequence of heads and tails.
The random generators, Dr. Nelson, are they like mini computers?
Well, there isn't necessarily any kind of computer in them, although we actually do use in one of the types of devices a microprocessor anyway, but that's really only for doing some electronic logic to make sure that there's no bias. It's not an algorithm. It's not a calculation. This is a true random process. One can think of it as the same kind of thing as radioactive decay, which is used for random sources sometimes. But in this case, it's just this quantum process of electron tunneling, which is itself unpredictable by its very nature, and which gives us a sequence of bits that are themselves unpredictable and when you add them all up, they produce a random number.
You've got them scattered all around the globe. How many and why'd you do that?
Well, there are 65 usually. About right now, there are actually a few more than that. 70 the last time I did an analysis. The reason for doing that is to be able to ask other questions than one can with a single isolated REG. We wanted to find out if distance matters. So you can see that it would be useful to have, well, a good deal of distance involved in the situation. We wanted to look at what we were thinking of as a potential global consciousness, that is a kind of interaction of human consciousness all around the world that might produce something new, or at least something that we don't know how to see otherwise, which we could think of as a kind of global consciousness. It's not entirely clear that we'll ever be able to prove that what we're seeing, that is the changes in the data that we see, are really caused by something you can call global consciousness, but it's a kind of operational definition of what we're interested in. We wanted to find out if when there are really great events in the world, events that attract the attention, maybe stir the emotions of really large numbers of people, we wanted to see whether we could capture some representation or some manifestation of that in this electronic system.
Can you conclude at this point, Roger, that distance does not affect these at all, or they need to be in the proximity of where people are?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's one of the ingoing notions was that this network placed all over the world would be responsive to the event wherever it was. And that's true in large measure. But in the meantime, we also have learned more. We know now that at least one major contribution to this kinds of effects that we see is correlation between the devices. These are random devices, and they are, in a sense, by definition, independent of each other. But it turns out that in the presence of the strong, synchronized, or common emotion that people sometimes develop, that in such a situation, there develops a very small but surprisingly consistent correlation among these devices. I probably should run through that again at some point, but basically
sure.
This network that is supposed to be and is designed to be a network of data that's coming into a central server from completely independent, functionally independent devices out in the world, that those data tend to show correlations between the devices. Now, I'm back to distance. The devices, the random event generators, are separated by, we have two or three cases where they're close, within maybe 2 or 3 kilometers of each other, but most of them are separated by hundreds or thousands of kilometers up to half the Earth circumference. And it turns out that those which are closer give a slightly larger correlation than those which are further apart. So it isn't the word that we often use in this business is non-local.
Non-local, right.
Yeah, the effect is non-local largely or basically, but there seems to be just a little hint of locality. This doesn't mean that the effect, if, say, an event occurs in Berlin, that the effect will be only seen on random number generators in Germany. We'll still see it in Brazil or New York City, but it will be slightly less strong in the correlation of devices that are separated by long distances.
Does the spike with the generator occur before the event, or during the event, or after the event?
It is possible. We have some cases and some indications that there may be a kind of precursor where the network starts responding. It won't be just one device or a few devices, but the network measurement that we make may start changing somewhat before the event. this is a rather mysterious thing, and to be honest, we don't know 100% how to explain it.
Right, and we're going to get into 9/11
in
a moment, because this could be one of those examples. But go ahead.
Yeah. Well, 9/11 is a particularly good example. The data in one of our measures started changing at about 4:30 or somewhere between 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, and the first plane hit the towers at, I believe it was 8:45.
Right around there, yeah.
Several hours. In other words, the network began to respond several hours before the apparent precipitating event.
When that was happening, when you were beginning to see the response, did you say, something's happening here? You don't necessarily know what or where, but were you able to say at that point, I think something's happening? I mean, had you had enough data over the years to analyze that and feel that?
Again, a very nicely phrased question. The answer is no, but it's because we don't look at the data in a continuous, ongoing fashion. We can only see such things as this early precursor response
right
after the fact. It's possible, in principle, to have a real-time display, and we do have one, but it just shows the activity of the individual devices, and looking at that, you can't see really anything about what's going to turn out to be changes in the measure, in our statistical measure. But if we had been running some kind of a, let's say, change detector on the data and had it set up to beep at us or whatever, this would have started beeping probably by 5 o'clock anyway, well before the first plane hit, because the data just changed so radically at that time, it becomes unmistakable if you're looking at the data trace, which, by the way, people can do on the Noosphere or Global Consciousness website.
Oh, absolutely, and it's a great tool. So this brings up an interesting paradox, and that is, and let's just talk about it in terms of the precursor.
Okay.
Did the generator spike because of this consciousness feeling of everybody in general, specifically maybe people in New York, where it was so strong?
Mm-hmm.
And then my next question would have been, if that's yes, how did they know? How did they know this through their conscious mind? Or were you picking up the readings of the hijackers of the day?
Good. You've hit both the two likely explanations in my mind. My preferred explanation is it's a global consciousness, if you will, can have premonitions just as individual humans seem to do. As you know, I'm sure, there's a long, long lore and almost equally long literature about premonitions and precognition and so forth. I know my friend Dean Radin has been on your show,
sure.
Probably talked about presentiment.
Yeah.
Well, maybe this is presentiment on a large scale, but and therefore a little longer than the few seconds that's found in these laboratory experiments with individuals. We are, after all, a huge mind. If we're talking about a mind, it's the big one, and it probably moves a little on a little different time scale.
Sure.
But back to your alternative explanation, I think it's almost certain that around that time, the hijackers who were going to be boarding planes and so forth are getting up, doing their prayers, and committing themselves to die.
Mm-hmm. Thinking of the event.
Yeah, they'd be accompanied also by who knows how many, probably another 50 or...
Maybe more than than we'll ever know, Roger.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So they were in an intense and probably shared, coordinated, synchronized state of mind. So there's every good reason to give that a reasonable place on the list of potential explanations. There are some other cases, and I can tell you about one particular kind of analysis that we've done that gives a little bit more weight, I think, to the global consciousness premonition version. We have, you know, continuous data running for years and years and years. And there are lots of other things that happen on a continuous basis over the years. My friend and colleague Peter Bensel in Paris decided to look at great earthquakes. Now, we've already had a number of earthquakes in our formal database where we select an event because we think it might be one that brings people together, and then we do an analysis. We do that in a formal way, making the setting up a hypothesis test before there's any kind of examination of the data. But we can also do these kind of retrospective analyses. So Peter pulled out all the big earthquakes, anything Richter magnitude 6 and greater, that means that it's a destructive earthquake. There are about 600 in the database when he did this a year or two ago, and about 500 of those are in the ocean, but they don't matter to anybody. But about 100 of these big earthquakes are on land, and they do affect people. They destroy houses and cities and sometimes kill people. So then these two separate versions or aspects of the database were treated with the same kind of analysis that we do for the formal events. And the result is a graph, one way to think of it, that shows a pattern, shows a really clear structure, a very interesting one, for those earthquakes on land, and a graph for the earthquakes in the oceans that show no pattern at all. So there's a big distinction between the two. The thing that we know that might make a difference is that in one case, people are conscious of it. Now, let me just describe the pattern. Think of the point in time when the main trembler of the earthquake occurs. There's a V-shaped curve where the data line wanders randomly and then begins dropping and reaches its lowest point right at the time of the earthquake and then comes back up again and becomes normal. The beginning of that drop is about 8 hours before the earthquake. It's about 8 hours before any detection system of any sort, other than perhaps this one, can see any sign of an earthquake. So it almost sounds like we have an earthquake detector, but the data are so noisy that this pattern is only becomes clear when you have 40 or 50 or more earthquakes.
Interesting.
It's striking, and it's a completely separate indicator that this network of random devices may be sensitive to something happening in consciousness space, and that might start that the response of the network might begin early.
Will it ever get to a point, Roger, where you will know what the event might be? And my example is, will you see certain spikes, let's say, that have a pattern for earthquakes, another one for severe fires, another one for wars, another one for like 9/11?
Right.
Might you be able to get to that type of category where you go, well, this kind of a spike, we know there's an earthquake. It's going to happen soon.
Uh-huh. I would like to think we are in a process of learning, and we do get progressively better at finding, let's say, not just one, but two or three independent measures that can be combined. And that means the system becomes more sensitive, because when you have two, let's say two heads are better than one, two statistical analyses are better than one. So we're improving, but it's really a long way. I wouldn't want to say never. But we're a long way from being able to make that kind of application.
Let's talk more about this fascinating Global Consciousness Project when we come back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Dr. Roger Nelson of the Global Consciousness Project. Roger, explain to us how the generator itself works. What's behind the instrumentation that allows it to register these spikes, these ones, these zeros? How does it pick up the mass consciousness thought, for example? How does that work?
You're asking, they used to say, $64,000 question. think it may be more than that now. I mean,
are they like radio receivers, or what are they?
I think they're information receivers, frankly. And my favorite model for how this works is something along the lines of a kind of information field generated by consciousness. Some people actually say consciousness field. I think that this is just a hand-waving picture, but I like it myself. You, when you're thinking and feeling, and I also, when I have thoughts, those thoughts are not stuck inside my head. They extend out into the world.
Like a radio wave would.
Well, a little bit.
Yeah, okay.
But the closest thing in most people's experience is something like falling in love. You meet somebody, you think it is a really nice person, and the two of you agree on that, and pretty soon there seems to be something new, a kind of, one could say, a couple, a consciousness comprised of the two people. That's that didn't exist before, and I think what it might be made of is the interacting, interpenetrating consciousness fields of two individuals. If you have a group that comes together to do, let's say, do a ritual or enjoy an incredibly captivating piece of music, we stop being just inside our skulls and we have a kind of presence out in the world, and the presence of each of us intermixes with the presence of others. And if there's some synchronizing character to the experience that we're sharing, that is, if we're all drawn and caused to focus by the event or the activity, then I think we have a situation that might be a little bit like throwing pebbles into a pond and having those waves interact with each other. So we create something new called a group consciousness, and ultimately when there's a major event that really stirs the emotions of huge numbers of people, like 9/11, then I think our consciousness waves interpenetrate, interact, and create something new, a global consciousness. And that is essentially an information field. Now, back to the REG devices. They are random in the sense that their future is completely open. It's completely unpredictable. That means it could be something different from what it might be. And what I think happens, what might happen, is that the information in a consciousness field can be absorbed by a device that has nothing better to do than to change very slightly. So I think in the case of these major global events changing our network, they create correlations between these devices by imposing some new information on those devices in a kind of synchronized manner. That's a long-winded sort of explanation.
Sure. Who invented this, the machinery?
Well, the idea of randomicity has been around a long time. The use of these random sources or random devices of various kinds goes way back in psychic research. People used dice early on, or they did other kinds of things that would be random. But I think the electronic version might have started around 1950 or so. But it really came into sharp focus as an instrument for clear and clean laboratory experimentation on consciousness affecting the physical world in the 70s. When a man named Helmut Schmidt developed not only some devices, he used mostly radioactivity, but the product is the same as our electronic ones, and asked people to try to either predict what the random sequence would be next or try actually to change it by thinking about it. So that was that became a kind of paradigm for experimentation in laboratory efforts to find out whether consciousness could change the world ever so slightly. And it was developed by quite a number of laboratories, including ours, to a fairly high degree of sophistication over the next two or three decades.
Are we at a point now, Roger, where we can make a conclusion about these random generators?
Well, I'm personally 100% sure that there's something very interesting going on. I can't say that we know how it works exactly, although there are plenty of theories, among others, that there's a kind of entanglement, physics, quantum physical interconnection amongst all objects, including brains and REGs. But the data are really very good. If you ask some skeptic who doesn't necessarily pay attention to the data, he'll say, oh, that's impossible, and brush it off. But there have been, we've done a number of meta-analyses. Dean Radin and I started in, I guess, as 87 with the publication of a meta-analysis, meaning we gathered all the experiments that we could find that had asked the same question from dozens of different investigators in independent laboratories and put them all together to produce a larger scale analysis, taking data from all these independent sources. And the answer was an unmistakable, highly significant, billions to one, or really very highly improbable that this kind of thing should happen by chance.
Was there a spike during that Indonesian tsunami that killed several hundred thousand people?
Yes, it's very complex. However, the formal prediction that we made showed only a modest change in the direction of the prediction, to be sure, but it wasn't the sort of thing one would say that matches the severity of the event. Of course, who knows what's supposed to happen to these REGs? Natural disasters aren't as potent as human-caused disasters in our data. Earlier, you were asking if we could tell the difference between a railroad crash and a terrorist attack and a celebration. And the answer is that we're beginning to be able to pull those kinds of things apart a little bit. But the data are what people refer to as low signal to high noise, low signal to noise ratio data. So it takes a lot of measurements of the same kind of thing to be sure that you're really capturing something instead of seeing a spike that really is just a random fluctuation, or goes the other way too. Maybe in many cases when we look at the data and don't see much, it will be because it's buried by the noisiness of the data.
Speculative question.
Yes.
Let's assume you had one of these generators in a school. And as horrible as this question is going to sound, there's a method to my madness here, Roger.
Hmm.
But you had a generator in this school, and prior to that, you had kids all over the place. The event is some sicko goes in there and does a Columbine.
Hmm.
Okay? He shoots up the whole place.
Right.
Do you think... this is speculative, of course, but this is based on some of your past research. Do you think that generator would have shown some kind of a spike before this guy came into the school?
It might, but the problem is what I mentioned before. We have such a low signal-to-noise ratio that the spike might be buried in the noise. We actually have looked at...
So it's not a huge spike we're seeing.
No, there really never is. Even on 9/11, it took, it takes a couple of hours worth of data collection over a period of, that's relevant, to be sure that there's really a change in the data. And
okay.
That was an extreme, extreme case. And let me tell you, the same thing in a different way. We made our formal prediction, and then the measure that shows that responds that looks at that we were looking at the time of the crashes. We had a four-hour period, roughly, in the formal, no knowledge of the data, the prediction that we made ahead of time. That wasn't anywhere near enough to capture what happened. So the changes occurred and stayed, stayed in the outer realms, you might say, for two full days. That was such a powerful event that it shows up mightily in our data, and it's extraordinary. But you can see if it takes 2 days to really fully develop the what we're referring to sometimes as a spike, then it won't turn out to be a useful detector.
How can you modify these generators to be a little more sensitive so that they spike at such a great way, you're able to see that?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know any really good answer other than one which isn't practical, and that is to use something like living systems as the detector. These random devices are remarkably flexible and effective for our research, but the main reason is that we know what they're supposed to do, and they do that in a very very stable, very predictable way. Namely, they produce random data normally. And we know that so we can use such a device in an experiment with intention in a laboratory, say, try to get high numbers. Do this for 2 minutes and try to get low numbers for 2 minutes. And we can run a nice experiment that way. The same experiment using a living system can be much, much more sensitive, say, 2 or 3 times, but it's really hard to keep it stable.
I wonder if in the future, and if you keep doing what you're doing, Roger, maybe we will get like this, where people will have little random generators, maybe the size of a cell phone, personally, a pocket-sized thing, that has like an audio beep to it. And let's say they're about ready to come upon, you know, an accident scene or an intersection. Nothing's happened yet, but that they may be involved in some horrible tragedy. All of a sudden, this thing goes off, and it makes them realize, you know, I better slow down or I better watch what I'm doing. I wonder if in 50 years or 100 years if we'll ever get there like that.
How about day after tomorrow?
That's aggressive. You think we can?
Let me give a couple of plugs. My friends at the Psyleron business, Psyleron, are making devices. They're not for warnings, but they're making available a process that can be accessed by your cell phone.
Amazing.
And it will, literally, here's what happens. They have something called Sync Text, and your listeners might well be interested. Look up Psyleron, Psyleron, .com, and this system allows you to send them, the company, a bunch of messages that you might like to get on your cell phone. Things like, well, that's a problematic situation. I wouldn't go. Or, this sounds great. It's time to sign on. Or, I know you've been thinking about me, or whatever. A bunch of messages. And occasionally, the random process that's assigned to you will hit a spike and send you a message, maybe once or twice a day. And people have been finding it's really remarkably
That's weird. Apt. That's something.
May I give a couple of other plugs?
Sure. They're not plugs. It's information.
All right. It's information. People who might like to come to a live talk and see all the graphs and so forth could consider going to the IRVA conference, which is coming up and starting on the 19th in Las Vegas. That means International Remote Viewing Association. And if anybody's interested, they can look up IRVA conference.
Is this with John Alexander?
Yeah, John Alexander.
I may be there. I may go to that.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, then I'll have a chance to meet you, George.
Absolutely.
And one of my favorite organizations is the SSE, Society for Scientific Exploration, which publishes the Journal of Scientific Exploration. And people can find out about that at scientificexploration.org. That's one word, scientific exploration. Another favorite organization is Parapsychology Association, and there you can find that you can find by going to parapsych.org. And then one more piece of information: I'm probably I understand that people become interested and would like to make some contact, and I may get quite a few emails. What I'd like to suggest people do instead of sending me emails is to send emails or go to a new set of forums that I've recently created, at forum.commonpassion.org. There's an organization called Common Passion, with which I'm associated, is kindly hosting several forums that can talk about technical stuff or questions that aren't answered in the frequently answered questions on my website and so forth. But that might be a place for people to meet each other, and I'll look in and see if I can make useful comments on questions that people might have.
Roger, where would you like to see the GPCP project head?
Well, I'd love to be able to develop a kind of, a kind of compact form of the information we have discovered that really allows people to understand that we are interconnected. The fact is we've got a whole lot of problems going on. I have one of your advertisements in the break. I notice is, why is all this happening all at once? And that, I think, might be associated with the fact that we have separated ourselves from each other too much, that we are designed and, in principle, are interconnected, and that this global consciousness data shows this in a rather strong and clear form. Whenever something big happens, we really do turn out to be interconnected, or we are one in a fashion that actually shows up in the data. That's, the ancient wisdom is that we never were separated in the first place. But we have taught ourselves to that individualism, me first, is the right way to go. And I'm myself convinced that the purpose, one might say, on a larger scale of something like the Global Consciousness Project information, is to let people know that we shouldn't be trying to go it alone. It's a lot more fun.
Absolutely. We're going to put all these links on our Twitter connection, twitter.com/coasttocoastam. And
we'll get
all those websites up there for you, Roger.
Oh, thank you.
You've got to be excited about this project. I mean, to be able to, dig deep into the human mind and realize that there's so much more than what we physically see or feel, and that consciousness truly does exist, has an incredible amount of, I think, force. And clearly you're demonstrating it in a fashion. It's exciting.
Oh, it is. It is indeed. I'm supposed to be retired, right?
Yeah. How old are you?
My wife says, oh, no way are you retired.
How old are you?
I'm 69 years old.
I'm 59 today.
Well, congratulations.
You got 10 years on me.
Happy birthday, George.
Thank you, Roger.
I
wonder if the whole planet spiked because of my birthday.
Quite possibly. Well, something that that people can do, I think it might not terribly often produce a spike or so, but people can download data from the GCP website and do analysis to their heart's content.
We're gonna keep you for questions next hour. You up?
Yeah, I am.
All right, we'll do it. Phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're with Dr. Roger Nelson of the Global Consciousness Project. Roger, who funds this? Grants, donations?
It's really donations. It's friends of the project and the idea who have, over the years, donated small amounts and, in a few cases, a little larger amount. But we run really on volunteer fuel. We have, probably 120 or 30 people that are engaged. Many of them are the hosts for this outlying egg host sites, and on the other hand, there's about 15 or 20 people that put in a tremendous amount of extremely valuable time as volunteers.
Truly a global project.
It really is, yeah. There are people all over the world contribute in various ways. Most of the sophisticated analysis gets done in Paris or Amsterdam or Northern California. It's all over the place.
On a 100% scale, with 100% being absolutely one, I know this to be true, How would you categorize one of these two questions? And we'll come back to what we talked about last hour. Mm-hmm. If the spike is generated by the person doing the event, like the terrorists, what percent do you think that could be?
Pretty small, probably about, I don't know, 5%.
5%, okay. So 95% you would say then it's being generated by the consciousness of the public at large.
That's what I would say. I mean, there's what I think of as convergent evidence. There's a bunch of different aspects of the data and the world situation that lead me to believe that it really is a global consciousness.
Okay. Now, with a 95% of global consciousness, what percent then would be being able to, through consciousness, pick up intuitive things about things that have not happened yet, as opposed to events that had already occurred, but you can feel their emotions?
Well, and that's a very interesting territory. I'm not quite sure this addresses your question, but one thing that's apparent to me is that even though I believe this is a function of the consciousness of people coordinated interlaced, interpenetrating, we aren't necessarily aware of it at all. We don't necessarily have to know or think about it. We only need to go about our business as human beings, and we are a functioning part. We don't just become; we are a part of a large matrix of consciousness. I have a metaphor. I mean, it's really more of an analogy. The brain is something like 10 billion neurons, which function in cooperation in clusters and bunches, and the result is a consciousness. They don't know anything about the consciousness, those neurons, and yet they produce it. They're the responsible source of our joy and our sadness and our ideas and our creativity. But they just do their job, which is to connect with each other. I think the human beings may be, you know, we operate in probably a somewhat similar fashion, where we have a slight advantage over the neurons in that we know this is possible. So I think the evidence in this project and from some other related kinds of work is that we are entirely capable of conscious evolution. We could decide and to become more interconnected and to tap into the resources of being a unitary whole, tap in and really create something sooner than we might imagine that is a little bit like a conscious global consciousness.
All right, let's go to some of the phones. San Francisco we go, west of the Rockies. Hello, Jenna, it's your turn.
Hey, George, I was going to sing you happy birthday, but I'll spare you. I'll just say it. Happy birthday.
We'll save that for another year.
Another time.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, what I wanted to ask your guest, Mr. Nelson, is, well, first of all, say that I had a vision of 9/11 2 weeks before it happened, and I don't know if there was a spike at that time, but my question really is have you had spikes that you couldn't identify to an event, and could this be what prophets see, or could it be a prophecy of something that may happen but you can't quite connect it?
The data from any kind of random system, and certainly including the Global Consciousness Project data, have spikes all the time. And probably some are associated with things in the world. We can't really identify it because the world is really huge and complex. So if we saw a spike in the data, we could look around and we might find a dozen things that could have been connected. So we do our research question from the other direction. We say, here's an event that we think might make a spike. And then we look at the data to find out, to confirm or deny the hypothesis that we made.
Mm-hmm. What I just wanted to say is that what I have seen for myself, and I've had precognition type of things, is that I've seen that the larger event that it is, the further out I see it.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I am saying that I saw 9/11 2 weeks out, And then I've seen other things, and they haven't happened yet, and they could be really potentially even more catastrophic. So that's kind of what I'm getting at.
Right. Well, you're pointing toward something that I think is true in general. We as human beings, conscious beings, are more sensitive than these random event generators are. You are probably a better detector of those kinds of things than our network. The advantage we have is that we can quantify it and, so to speak, prove that there is a correlation in your case or in the case of other people who are sensitive in the same way. We have a what's called anecdotal relationship. Over time, you can become fairly confident of your premonitions and maybe be able to use them. But it's not, and our system is a little different. We're just counting things, so to speak.
We can monitor the spikes just on the Global Consciousness Project website, right?
We
can monitor things that are happening?
Yes, it's entirely possible to do that. There is a kind of live display. On the homepage, there's a dot. And if you click on the dot, you get to a page that explains the colors of the dot, which show greater and different kinds of coherence. And there's a graph on that same page that shows what's been happening over a 24-hour period. So that goes up and down and produces spikes. And people can look at that and probably find it interesting. But my guess is that if we had 100 people looking at that and saying and trying to make interpretations about what it relates to in the world, we'd have 100 different opinions.
Roger, what do you think is happening? Not with the generators, but with the human mind, the consciousness. What's going on?
I think we're growing slowly toward what the Jesuit priest and theologian, actually also a paleontologist, named Teilhard de Chardin, was describing as the next phase of human evolution. I think we're in really, really early days, but Teilhard said, we're the pinnacle of evolution, but we're not finished. The next phase would be to become a layer of intelligence for the Earth. So we're working on that, but we have, as most of us are quite aware, a little ways to go before we're really operating like an intelligence. You remember I mentioned the human brain with all its neurons collaborating and cooperating produce a consciousness. I think we human beings have the potential to do that if we really did collaborate and cooperate in a fashion like the neurons do. We'd be a shell of intelligence, a brain that produces a consciousness that that really could determine the future. We're working on that, but it's a long way to go.
Bangor, Maine, we go. Nelson is east of the Rockies. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning. How you guys doing?
Good.
Thanks.
Yes, I was just had a question for Mr. Nelson. I am a firm believer that our thoughts do have a frequency. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of the law of attraction, but I feel that our thoughts do have a frequency. But I'm just trying to figure out how exactly that is measured. This consciousness you're talking about, how exactly it's measured to be able to get these spikes.
Well, essentially, we're measuring a correlation between what can be identified as structure or patterns in the data. That's really very simple statistical stuff, like the mean shifts or the variance increases or whatever, but most people aren't used to those terms. So anyway, we look for structure at a time when we think there ought to be some if global consciousness is real. So in other words, we aren't really, in a sense, we're not able to measure the consciousness, but we can see a correlation of something else that should be independent, but it is somehow correlated with what's happening in the world. Does that touch your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like there's any other applications of that other than just trying to find this consciousness?
Well, you tap into my philosophic bent if you ask that kind of question. I think we have a great deal to learn about the world and about ourselves, and this is the kind of thing that it's one avenue of questioning that helps us come to understand better what it means to be human, what consciousness is about. So we have, many other kinds of, many other research endeavors and maybe personal experiences and so forth. You put them together and thought in a thoughtful way, and you wind up with a better understanding of what it means to be human.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Nelson. Next up, Vince. You're in Seattle. Go ahead, Vince.
Oh, hey, George. By the way, you are a great steward of Coast to Coast.
Thank you.
Roger, I have a question here. I've often believed that animals, I'm not sure if they have a soul, but I know that they have consciousness.
You bet.
And what, especially before earthquakes, animals seem to know, you know, when an earthquake is going to happen before people. What, first of all, what's your opinion about getting the pods to collect the animal's consciousness, number one? And then number two, I have a question about sports stadiums. Have you ever put a pod in a sports stadium to see how these spikes might happen? And I'll take your answers off the air. Thank you very much.
Sure.
On the first point, I think I totally agree that animals have consciousness. In the global consciousness events, we're generally speaking defining them in terms of human interest and so forth. If we had a way of defining them in terms of animal consciousness or trees, for that matter, I think we might be able to find somewhat similar kinds of things. But that's a problem for another, another research project.
And the next thing is putting one of these units in a sports stadium.
We actually have looked at world scale or world class kinds of sporting events, in particular the World Cup, which is really international. World Cup soccer happens every 4 years. There are a series of matches, and we've had a chance to look at 2002 and 2006, and that next will be 2010. And there is suggestive evidence that the global consciousness is paying attention. No big surprise, but it's very complicated, and we're still uncertain even after two big rounds of analysis. One thing about sports is that in contrast to something like a celebration, say New Year's, or a horrendous event like 9/11 that gathers everybody and points them in the same direction, in sports you have a competition that's going on. So it's not we still need to learn more about this, but it's possible that the competition, even though there's a lot of excitement and so forth, that there may be two different things that are kind of mixing together and possibly even canceling each other in terms of the coherence that we believe is necessary for there to be a noticeable effect on the random event generators.
What's the moment of excitement that would come from these generators for you, Roger, that you would sit back and go, oh, my, look what we've done?
Oh, my, that's a good question. I guess I'm already something like perpetually excited that they do anything at all. This was a kind of shot in the dark in a way. We had experiences that suggested doing it. There was a lead-in or lead-up to this project. But still, the first event we looked at was the long, long time ago. There were the first big terrorist attacks that I was aware of were bombings of embassies in Africa. There were two of them in late 1997. They blew our response in the consciousness space, really knocked our REG network, which was small and new at the time, for a loop. So I said, oh, my God. So now 9/11 was another one of those. But so is New Year's. New Year's produces a pattern. We predict it the same thing every year. We think, we all calm down and kind of synchronize when it comes close to midnight. And the data look like that. It's really quite interesting.
Next up, whose turn? North Hollywood we go. Bob, it's you. Hi.
Hey, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Fantastic show. It's really interesting. Everybody says, did Irene say it's regs or is it eggs with an E? It's ours, regs, isn't it?
Eggs.
Well, we call the installation out there an egg, and it comes from my son helped with the programming and architecture for the software early on, and he said, you know, this is a little bit like you're doing something, a little bit like what the EEG people do for
call.
So he said, why don't you call it an electrogyogram, an abbreviation EGG?
There you go, reading the mind of God.
So, and by the way, the software that takes the data and archives it on the server, that's the basket. So we have a bunch of eggs and a basket to collect the data.
Wow, it's a Gaia scope, I guess.
Well, something like that. And it may well be, you know.
Yeah.
We don't know, but what Gaia, Mother Gaia, is out there chiming in when it's time.
Exactly. My main concern with technology is whenever the human race designs advanced technologies, they use it for evil. Atomic energy, blow up people, kill people. And with this device, I could see the future of this being able to map human consciousness. It's operating as a receiver. And once they've got it completed, what prevents them from turning it around into a transceiver to control human consciousness itself?
Well,
good point.
I think probably the best bet is human consciousness itself. I mean, at the best idealization we can come up with, consciousness should be self-serving in the sense of trying to get what it needs. And a global consciousness doesn't need destruction. After all, if we really are ultimately going to integrate and become one around this globe, that will both save the globe from the destructive tendencies that you mentioned and create something that might be what somebody mentioned, God, what might be what God intended.
Okay, great. Thanks. Let's go next. Joan in Texas, east of the Rockies. Hey, Joan.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome, and I'll put you on hold, and we'll get you right back when we come back. I didn't want to lose your place in line. Roger, if you had a group of Tibetan monks and they were concentrating, would they spike the generator higher than just a group of folks sitting in the same room?
I think there's a good chance they'd have a stronger effect. We have actually done that kind of analysis. Not with Tibetan monks, but with meditators and synchronized meditations, various kinds, including the Transcendental Meditation Group.
So people who are more tuned in, maybe more aware of their consciousness or their intuitive powers, generally could do a better job spiking.
Right. We have a kind of exploratory database from the Paralab days, actually also done by my colleague Peter Bensel, who took an experiment, a laboratory-type experiment, to monasteries where Buddhist monks were gathered and asked them to do the same thing that, you know, regular folks do in the lab, and they could do it better. I think it's a matter of being two or three things. One of them is just being able to stay with a task, and another one is to get out of the way. You know, meditation is one of the things that meditation does, is teach people to get out of their own way.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Lewistown, Montana. Kirby, good morning. You're up with us.
Hi, George. Belated happy birthday.
Thanks, Kirby.
And you were talking about how the sensors reacted by like 4.5 about 4 in the morning or so. I was flying out of Newark that night, and I noticed that when I looked out from the terminal in Newark over to towards Manhattan, that it had the eeriest greenish cast that I've ever seen. And I flew back to Houston at the time, and the next morning one of my friends called me up and told me what had happened, and I just thought, wow, that really did look strange, and I never thought that that the city might even have some sort of a mentality that it would generate a strange look like that. Does that seem at all tied in?
Well, maybe. I think your experience is the same kind of thing that many people had in with different forms. They might not see the kind of city aura that you did looking strange, but many people dreamed or didn't go to work or had some kind of experience that in retrospect is readily interpreted as some kind of a premonitory recognition that something big is, and in this case very bad, is about to happen. I don't, you know, we have such a hard time studying those things formally. So that's why we do the laboratory kinds of things, which are really faint and weak approximations to the experience that people have.
Roger, over the years, have you all adjusted the random generators or the approach? Have you made any fine-tuning?
That's George, you have the greatest question. the answer is that we haven't adjusted the REGs. They were designed well, and they do their job, and they're fantastically sturdy. They've been, many of them, running for these 10 years. But we've learned a great deal about how to ask questions. We've learned what sort of things might produce some effect, and we've learned to deal with the fact that some events will produce an effect opposite to what we predict. We say, okay, so we lose something from our grand total, but we learn. And we've also developed what we think of as kind of deeper analysis strategies, where we look at more aspects of the data. We learn by looking from different angles more about it. So the adjustments are mainly in learning how to ask the questions well and get more refined answers from the analysis.
Great. Let's go west of the Rockies now. Danny in Covina, California is with us. Hi, Danny. Good morning. Good.
I had a question for your guest. Back in July 99 or 98, July 16th through the 21st is when Jupiter got hit by the comet. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
I was wondering, since everybody's eyes are fixed on the heavens at those times and eclipses and when scientists look for solar flares and things like that, and everybody's paying attention,
mm-hmm.
Not just the human consciousness, but, you know, maybe natural events that are going to affect humans in the future. Because, you know, like they say the dates like 2012 is going to be when the solar system aligns with the center of the whole entire galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like I heard that's like a 2012, it's actually like an astrological event, a real one, not just like the end of the world type of thing, but Earth is going to come into a type of relation to the center of our own galaxy at that time too.
Maybe, yeah.
Well, with regard to 2012, some colleagues and I are planning to work toward creating a planetary smile for 2012. We'd like that to be a turning point that's real, but is a turning point in a positive, very positive direction. But back to the question about the Jupiter event, we don't have an analysis of that, although if it happened during the time we're collecting data, that's still possible. We have this historical record where we can look at anything. But something very similar was a solar eclipse in 1999 in August. There we made a prediction way ahead that, as you say, a lot of people would be focused on that. What would our data look like? And it's really very interesting. It teaches us, for example, that distance isn't necessarily geographic. It might be psychological. Here's what happened. We had about 25 or so eggs running at the time. Seven of them were in the path of that eclipse where the shadow actually hit, and therefore people were able directly to experience the eclipse rather than, say, looking at it on television. In the data from those seven devices, we had an enormous effect, but for the network overall, not so much. So there's a kind of lesson about focused consciousness and the immediacy of experience.
How much of a spike would you have to get on these generators, Roger, where it would be easier to see?
Well, we'd have let me put it in terms of an effect size. As it now stands, the average effect size over all the events we look at is somewhere between a third and a half a standard deviation. We need something close to two standard deviations to be sure there's an effect. So when you do the mathematics, it turns out that we would need something like an effect 20 times as big or 15 times as big as we see on average for it to show up in any individual event. We wish we knew how to amplify things that much. Eventually, by having multiple measures, independent, but looking at the same thing and combining those, we can create some amplification, but so far we don't know how to do it by a factor of 10 or 15.
Ogilvy, California, first-time caller. Roger, it's all yours.
Hey, guys, how you doing tonight?
Okay, Roger.
Birthday, George.
Thank you.
Happy to say I've been listening for 20 years. I had two quick questions. One, what percentage of spikes do you have that you can attach to specific events? And the other question I had was understanding the machine, which I assume it's a machine that puts out zeros and ones, and a spike would be a whole bunch of zeros and ones in one particular place that happens preceding or just after a large event. And that's all I got for you.
For the full detail, you probably should check out the website, which you can just type in Global Consciousness and you'll get there, or Google on GCP.
All right.
The size of the remind me the first part of your question. I'm sorry.
It was, what percentage of spikes do you have
okay. That
you can specifically attach to an event?
Right. Well, we can't really do it that way. If we just look for spikes and try to find some event that's associated, because there's so many events and possibilities, we'll never know whether anything in particular is responsible for the spike. So we do it the other way around. We look for events that we think are a good bet for gathering global consciousness, and then we analyze the data to see if there is a deviation from expectation, a spike. And so in terms of how many bets we place and how much we win, about 70% of the time we're right. We make our prediction and our hypothesis test, and it turns out that we've made the right guess. I mentioned earlier in the show that this system produces a tremendously noisy kind of data. That's what random data really are. And in a sense, we're lucky we can see anything at all, because the signal that these events produce, or global consciousness produces, is small, and it has to be a big event gathering the consciousness inputs of huge numbers of people, like millions of people, in order for us to be able to identify the event, see it. And as for how the machine works, we have in each of these devices produces a sequence of ones and zeros, as you said, at a high rate. And each second we collect 200 of those and add them up. So the expectation is that's like flipping 200 coins. You'll get an average of 100, sometimes 107, sometimes 92, and so on. But so every second, day after day, year after year, each one of the 60 or 60, 65 devices produces a sequence of numbers like 100, 105, 113, 94. Okay?
When computers get better, Roger, in the future, will that make these generators better?
No, but it might make our analysis better.
Ah.
We'll be able to do more of it. Even as it is, we are able to process, the simple kinds of questions in a moment. More complicated things to understand the background may take a day or two of calculation. And when we have better computers, faster, or just buy more of them, we'd be able to do what takes a day. We'd be able to do that in a moment.
Okay, back to the phones we go. Let's go to Houston, Texas. Hey, John, you're up.
right. Thank you, George. Happy birthday to you, man.
Thank you.
Oh, listen, I was going to ask your guest there if he had ever listened to any of the guys that were talking about that Merlin project.
That's Paul Gersio and Dr. George Hart. Familiar with them at all, Roger?
I'm not sure, at least by name. There's the, what's the project do?
They've got software called Merlin, which they feed through a computer, and it, too, spits out numbers and spikes for timelines, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been pretty accurate, I would say. Wouldn't you, John?
Yes, sir. They predicted the economic crash right to the one day off.
Yep.
And they also are pretty sharp. And also, if he could someday meet with Dr. Turi and have a coffee, I would love to be a fly on the wall when they meet.
Well, I think maybe I do know that. This is a half-past human.
Mr. Turi is extremely knowledgeable when it comes to foretelling the future. He's like a student of Nostradamus, and he's been 40 years studying astrologies and things. Uh-huh. You know.
Well, there's another group. Do you know the name George Urie?
Oh, sure. We've had them on too.
Yeah,
the bots project,
the half-past human stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, the web bot analysis. There are a number of people doing this kind of analysis of what's happening for, you know, blogging. There's one group that does looks at the emotional ups and downs expressed by analyzing blogs.
Twitter, which is a new website, mm-hmm. is going to do a remote viewing.
All right, I know about that.
Oh, are you part of it?
No, I'm not.
Okay, you should be.
That's run by a man named Weissman, who is he's a well-known parapsychologist with a very strong skeptical bent.
So maybe that's the twist they'll take, huh?
Who knows?
Yeah.
If we were really good remote viewers, we would know already, right?
Nothing wrong with skeptics if they have an open mind.
Totally. We profit greatly from people who are skeptical but willing to do the work. A lot of skeptics, so-called, will say, oh, it's not possible. I don't believe it. It's hogwash. But they don't do their homework, and that's unfortunate.
Let's go to San Benedito. Joan, east of the Rockies. Hey, there you are.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for taking my call, and happy birthday.
Thank you, Joan.
Yes. I was wondering if the spikes had been correlated with the sensitivity of the animals concerning earthquakes.
Well, we see... we see a change in our data starting several hours, about 8 hours, maybe a little more, before really big earthquakes that happen in areas of the world where people will be affected.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see any such thing when the earthquakes happen in the ocean, and of course there are animals in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little early days to interpret that in a, you know, precise way, but the Chinese, as you probably know, and other people have long since paid a great deal of attention to what's happening to animals, or what kind of activity the animals are doing, in order to get a little bit of lead time on earthquakes.
Yeah, I thought maybe that may be one of the reasons that the whales have been beaching themselves.
Oh my God! I hope not.
Yeah.
If you mean,
but you never know.
No, I don't know about that, and we aren't able to do a precise kind of correlation.
What's the next on your list, Roger? What do you do with this project?
We're continuing to do the deeper analysis to learn more about how it works, what matters and what doesn't. That includes such things as categorizing the events that we already have to find out which ones produce an upward trend and which ones produce a downward trend, and hopefully more precision there. We're also just at the beginning of a collaboration with a bunch of other people. This is still planning stages, which will be essentially a kind of replication of the Global Consciousness Network that will have a slightly different purpose, but is also aimed toward the idea of a conscious evolution. I'm talking here now partly because I think my next stage or mission will be to try to give people an understanding of this in hopes that it will provide a stimulation for people to connect with each other, look more deeply into their own motivations and purposes, and maybe, as you say in one of your promos, discover that we are really kind of unitary organism.
Absolutely. I think as people study more of this and the work that you do, Roger, people are going to find themselves in this incredible machine we call the human body, and then what else is out there beyond that?
Yeah. I think we're in a position, because we're creative creatures, to just to make a decision and move in a direction that most people aren't really at this point confident is possible. We need to gather confidence in our ability to, you know, make things work.
Might see you in a few weeks in Las Vegas, Roger. I know it's a great conference. Dr. Roger Nelson, the Global Consciousness Project. Up next, Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM.